Synopsis. It'll feel too tropical. That's not the aesthetic at all, Sayla snaps, glaring at the older woman. It seems like too harsh a response for a conversation about flowers. Before the gnome can defend herself, Miko chimes in. Not at all. She stands up from her chair and pulls her headphones back until they hang around her neck like a yoke. She walks over to Sayla, opening the cover of her sketch pad. I'm already nervous for Miko because she's the only person in the room who hasn't waited to be spoken to before speaking herself. Sayla doesn't seem to question it, though, just looks at the sketch in front of her. See, we just added a bit in here for the color, Miko says, pointing to something on the page. And the cymbidiums? Sayla asks. Overkill, I think, Miko says decisively. Sayla considers the page again. Agreed, she says finally, then looks up at the gnome again. You've made her aware of the changes? It's not really a question. Yes, she's excited about this direction. The gnome responds. She's excited about the dissolution of her design scheme 3 days before her event? Sayla raises her voice. Miko interrupts again, waving a hand through the air in a staying motion. She is. We showed her the new design, and I mentioned I haven't incorporated this combination into a piece before. She's thrilled to set the trend. The gnome looks relieved at not having to answer. Sayla looks irate, kind of like the angry cat on Miko's shirt. Well done, Jen, Sayla finally says, begrudgingly, and Miko walks back to her chair without acknowledging the praise. More than a few people throw pointed looks at the little designer she takes her seat, but she either doesn't know or doesn't care. Miko's clearly a Sayla favorite whether she wants the title or not. The Riverton party is new, but since it's moving so quickly, I suggest we discuss it next, Quade says. About the venue? Sayla begins, but McKenna interrupts, suddenly overeager. I was able to secure Milk Studios. I had to beg to get them to release the date. But JJ owes me a favor, and who approved that? Sayla's sharp tone ricochets off the windows behind me, and the already quiet room grows ominously more so. Holy crap. You asked me to get... McKenna tries. Absolutely not. The brand asked for something exclusive and fresh, and Milk is so overdone it's nearly pedestrian. Sayla attacks with far more venom than seems necessary. In fact, last time I checked, it was my name on the wall. So maybe you can explain why decisions are being made about my company without my input. It must have been a miscommunication, McKenna says quietly. When you asked me to book it, I... Tell me you weren't idiot enough to confirm, she hisses. It takes everything I have not to cower down in the seat alongside McKenna, who looks like a beaten puppy. I did, but I'm sure I can, McKenna tries. Oh, you will. It's not my job to correct your mistakes. And I'm not even sure why I'm having this conversation with a second assistant. She says his title the same way she called me this girl. And even though he's a jerk, I feel so badly for McKenna. The entire room is looking anywhere but his direction. The party will be at 25. Sayla announces it like a proclamation. All around me, murmurs rise up in a swirl, praising her decision. Gorgeous space, someone says. Go there all the time. Love the vibe. Oh, it's sexy and masculine, a great departure from other Riverton parties. I'm surprised to hear McKenna agree loudest of all. I can't believe he can even find his voice after she just ripped him a new one in front of everybody. But apparently he rebounds quickly. Because as she starts to describe her vision for the party, he nods along emphatically like a church lady listening to a testimony. I half expect him to throw out an amen when she starts talking about the celebrity DJ she has in mind. I don't know how she's gone from flirtatious to complimentary to ruthless in the span of one meeting, or how her staff has learned to keep up. My gaze slides tentatively down the table to Miko, and at my wide-eyed stare she mouths the exact words I'm thinking. Pod people. Chapter 4. After the uncomfortable meeting, we make our way back to the office in silence. If it were me, I'd be railing to anyone who would listen about my nightmare boss or crying in a stairwell somewhere, but McKenna is doing his best to act like nothing happened. I excuse myself for the restroom, and once I've locked myself in the stall, my mind starts spinning. What do you do when you realize the woman you've idolized for years is a horrible person? Successful, brilliant, beautiful, sure. But also, kind of crazy harsh. I mean, I guess she needs to be sort of hardcore to run her team and her company. But she's so vicious, and it seems almost like she enjoys being mean. And that whole deal with the phone call and making everyone wait for her, and the way she can intone the simplest words with the venom of a rattlesnake? No, she is definitely not a nice person. I can't help it. I laugh. Not a nice person? God, I am such a country mouse. She's a crazy bee! Even I can see that. What am I gonna do, though? It's only my second day, and I've worked so long to get this position. I rub my now clammy palms down the front of the skirt of my dress and think about what it took to get here. Years and years of going home every day with my hair smelling like barbecue sauce and never spending the money I made on anything fun. Years of imagining what it would be like to help a bride choose the perfect flowers for her bouquet, or how it would feel to see my favorite actresses walk the red carpet at an event I've produced. It's all I've dreamed about for as long as I can remember. Selah is the best, period. I wanted to work for her so I could learn from the best, not because I want to be some evil minion she crushes in the all-hands meeting. I'm not here because I want to just work for her. I'm here because I want to be her. I want to be a fabulous event planner in my own right, and the only way I'm going to be able to do that is to stick it out and learn from the best. I've got to secure a real position here, even if it's hard. I've got to make myself stand out, to be the absolute best intern I can be so I can learn everything I need to know. I've got to... The door opens and closes as someone comes in, reminding me where I'm standing. I throw my shoulders back and turn the latch of the stall door. I will take this place by storm. But first, I've got to leave this bathroom. By the time afternoon rolls around, I'm deep in my hidey hole behind the office door, working on the borrowed laptop on jewel-themed decor ideas. My locale has proved treacherous. Someone came barreling into the room and the door slammed into my elbow. I had to bite my tongue to keep from yelping out a blasphemous curse. That spot's going to bruise for sure. I'll be honest, being stuck in the corner is pretty degrading, but I suppose it's better than sitting outside the room on the floor. The partial obstruction of the door also means that I'm able to listen in on all the phone calls and conversations, and they mostly forget I'm here unless they need to bark an order at me. From their conversations, I've learned that we have an event this weekend, the aforementioned Learner Bar Mitzvah, with a rush order sailboat-themed keepote. Something, by the way, that Google informed me is another name for yarmulke, and apparently it's okay to have them custom designed to match your party so long as they cover your head. I looked up some pictures of them, too, and I thought the little themed hats were adorable. I wish Presbyterians got to wear something so cool. Snap, snap, snap. My head flies up at the sound of McKenna's fingers. He points down to the post-it on his desk. Time for coffee bean. This time, as I make my way back up Beverly munching the lonely bran muffin that was all that remained of the pastry section, I don't feel as terrified as I did yesterday. For one thing, Miko has explained to me how to pull petty cash for these coffee runs, so at least I won't go broke keeping my bosses supplied with caffeine. As far as those bosses go, Quaid hasn't ever spoken to me directly, and McKenna is even ruder than normal after the morning meeting. But I haven't openly pissed off anyone today, and that's going a long way towards boosting my confidence. On another positive note, I'm going to work my first SSE event this weekend. I should probably be a little more terrified after seeing Selah's temper firsthand, but I know I can impress her at this party. At least, I think I can. Back in the lobby of the SSE building, I juggle the coffee tray and hit the button for the elevator. I step in, and as the doors slide together, shove the entirety of the remaining muffin into my mouth in an attempt to finish it before I reach the top floor. No one has expressly forbidden it, but I'm pretty sure carbs aren't allowed inside this building. I have just started chewing the gorged mouthful when a hand flies between the closing elevator doors. The doors slide back open, and standing there is Jesus in his human form. Okay, not Jesus. Not Jesus, but easily the hottest man I've ever seen in my life. Did I just call Jesus a hottie? I did. I think I did, and I'm for sure going to burn in hell. I guess I just meant that this guy is so beautiful, he's got to be some kind of deity. He's well over 6 feet tall, and has perfectly tousled dark blonde hair and the lightest blue eyes I've ever seen. His skin is sun-brown surfer perfection. He's rocking the sort of scruffy 5 o'clock shadow, and he's got lips that no one of the male species deserves to have. He's wearing a perfectly cut, light gray suit, a crisp white button-down, and no tie. He doesn't necessarily look old, but he seems very grown up. He fairly oozes confidence and money, and I'm sure his suit probably costs more than my car. The guy takes a step inside the elevator and resumes tapping into the phone in his hands. I see him open another email on his screen and start reading, completely unaware of my presence. It's only after he starts typing a response that I realize I have a mouthful of muffin that I've stopped chewing, and I'm just staring at him like a deranged chipmunk. Kill me. I duck my head and do one massive swallow. Big mistake. Like all late-in-the-day pastries, this one is totally dried out, and it absolutely refuses to go down my throat. My eyes dart to him to make sure he's not looking at me. Of course he's looking at me! My eyes are bugging out, and I'm trying not to spill the coffees. I start choking and coughing like a moron, but I swear I'm doing my best to asphyxiate as demurely as possible. No, go. There's Dreamy Guy, looking all pulled together and gorgeous, and here's me, being all cough, spastic, breathe, wheeze, cough, cough, death rattle. This is it. I'm going to choke to death in an elevator dressed like I'm on my way to a hooker's funeral, and this blonde male model is going to watch me die. All of a sudden, he steps in front of me, looking concerned. Are you okay? Even as I'm coughing bits of bran muffin into my hand, I can't help but stare up at his mouth. His teeth are perfect. I wonder if he ever had braces. He doesn't wait for my response, since clearly I'm in no position to give him one. He just takes the coffee tray from me with one hand and starts pounding me on the back way too hard. My coughing fades slightly, and he reaches to grab a drink at random. Here, drink this. He hands me the coffee. I shake my head, my voice coming out squeaky. Not mine. He looks at me like I'm an idiot. I'm sure whomever it belongs to won't mind. I clear my throat about 14 times and then try and speak again. She'd mind. I choke out. I doubt she'd use the liquid in it to put me out if I was on fire. I reach out to take the tray back. The model looks at me skeptically but relinquishes the tray. If you say so. I nod stupidly and take one giant sideways step to give myself some space. He watches me for a beat and then turns around to face the elevator doors again. Through the speaker in the ceiling, Lionel Richie reminds me that he's easy like Sunday morning. It's the perfect awkward song for this horrendously awkward moment. God, can't this thing move any faster? I look up to see the progress of the elevator car. 3 more floors to go. Right then is when I realize that he hasn't hit the button for a different floor, which means he's also going to the top floor, and SSE is the only office up there, which means he's headed up there too. Ugh. Finally, blessedly, the doors open, and I don't even look at my companion or the rude receptionist. I make a beeline past the partition and head for my chair. I've never been so desperate to sit in a hidden corner in my life. Only, as I'm walking, I realize the model is following me. I don't hear him speak with the receptionist or anyone else, and no one acknowledges him as he trails behind me, so clearly, he being in the space isn't unusual. Oh, please, Lord and baby Jesus, do not let him be. Brody Ashton, you've kept me waiting. Selah purrs from the doorframe of her office. She's reapplied her lip gloss. I can see the shine all the way from here. Also, that flirty voice is back, and I know without question this is the Brody from her phone call earlier. I continue walking, but for the smallest moment I squeeze my eyes shut as if it might erase this car wreck that is my life. Just keep moving forward, keep smiling, nothing to see here, people. I walk towards Selah since she's standing directly in front of me and clearly sees that I've got her coffee in my hand. When I'm a few feet away, she nods towards her office. Put it on my desk, Brinkley, she says, looking past me. I walk past her and set the drink down on the desk, All the while, I'm wondering if maybe I should have just let the bran muffin take me when it had the chance. I turn from the desk, tray in hand, and keep my eyes trained on my shoes. When I get to the door, Selah's in my way, and I have no choice but to look up at her and Brody. Light blue eyes consider me for a second before looking away. "We seem to be in the way here," he says, pulling Selah to the side to let me pass.
"I didn't even think of getting you something, Bee. I can send her back if you want," Selah tells him.
She doesn't even look at me when she asks, just continues to stare at him, smiling her glossy, fake smile. "No, I'm good. Thank you, though. Are you ready?" I don't wait to hear what she says. I'm already back in the small office handing out the other coffees and thinking very seriously about how much alcohol I might need to drink to forget the last hour of my life. That night, McKenna doesn't let me leave until after 7. By the time I'm dismissed, I have copied, filed, collated, stapled, schlepped, and researched until I can't see straight, and I've done everything so fast I haven't had time to sit down in between. At this point, I'm so tired I can't imagine anything better than putting on my oldest sweatpants and eating a vat of mac and cheese on the couch. I head out to the elevator and spy Miko headed in the same direction. She takes one look at my face and declares that we're going to find a happy hour. "I don't know if I'm up for going out," I say dejectedly. "Oh, no. You need a drink. You look exactly like Clary when she found out she couldn't make out with Jace anymore because he was actually her brother." I'm embarrassed that I recognize that reference. The elevator doors open and we both get inside.
"Why is that embarrassing? Those books are epic."
Miko hits the elevator button. Though I do sometimes wish I didn't get so addicted to YA series. I mean, it's like book after book filled with heavy petting and all I want the characters to do is get it on. It's so frustrating, Miko says, rifling through a giant neon bag she has slung over her shoulder.
"I guess you could stop reading YA," I try helpfully.
"It's a love story about teenage half-angel warriors."
"I'm not made of stone," she says through a giggle, like it's the most absurd thing I could ever suggest.
She finally finds the lip balm she's looking for and dabs it on her lips. "Okay, where are we getting the drink?" I ask, watching as she drops the balm back into the black hole of clutter in her bag. I will never understand how people can live with such chaos. The inside of my bag is a collection of smaller bags, each with its own special purpose in the organizational hierarchy. "You get to choose. You're the one who got dream crushed today." Miko opens the door to the lobby and lets us out onto the sidewalk. It's early October, and back home it's already chilly, but here, it still feels tepid. We walk along the sidewalk in silence.
"What do you mean I got dream crushed?" I ask.
Miko takes a deep breath. "I mean that today you learned that this job isn't what you thought it was going to be. I mean that you can already tell how terrible Selah is, and it's only day 2. That makes you wonder what that means she's like on day 22 or day 137. It means you realize that you're working for one of the worst people you'll likely ever meet and that you understand if you want whatever future you've dreamed up for yourself, you're going to have to keep working for her for the foreseeable future. You had a vision for the way this was all going to go down, and today, that got blown to hell and back." She finishes succinctly. "Dream crushed." I stare down at my heels eating up the pavement beneath me.
"That sounds about right," I finally concede.
"Yep, let's find you some vodka." Since I haven't actually been out yet in L.A., I pick the only place I even know the name of. Gander, as it turns out, is a restaurant inside the Buchanan. The large wraparound bar that services both the restaurant and the hotel lobby at large is gigantic and sleek, and surrounded by an eclectic mix of people who can afford the overpriced cocktails. It's a place to see and be seen, and the ideal locale for anyone starting or ending a night in Hollywood. I'm thankful I haven't picked out something supremely cheesy, and I owe my knowledge of this cool location to the gorgeous but annoyed-looking bartender rocking a now perfectly styled pixie cut behind the bar. Max looks up from the cocktail she's mixing just as Miko and I find seats at the bar. She calls down to me.
"You finally decided to come in?"
She was dressed the same as all the other bartenders here, Skinny jeans, tight linen button-down shirt, thin suspenders. If I were wearing the uniform, I'd look like the ride operator on Big Thunder Mountain. On Max, it looks flawless. Desperate times, I reply as she walks over. What can I get you guys? Max asks. Miko pipes up. Any kind of cocktail involving liquor, and then we'll also need a sidecar of more liquor. I'm Miko, by the way, she says, tossing her neon bag onto the floor at her feet. Bad day? Max is already pulling unknown ingredients from below the bar to mix us something. Decidedly, not the best day I've ever had, I sigh. I told you she was an asshole, Max says. You did, in fact. How'd you know she was an asshole? Miko asks. I know some guys who've worked with her, Max answers while sliding us two tall, sleek shot glasses filled with an opaque pink liquid. What's this? I ask, sniffing the shot dubiously. A new creation. I call it cereal milk. It tastes just like milk left at the bottom of the cereal bowl. You seem like a pink shot kind of girl. Max's voice is sharp, but her smile is teasing. I'm beginning to suspect her bark is worse than her bite. I smile at my shot and the girl who made it, then down it in one swallow. She's right. It tastes exactly like cereal milk. This is delicious. Miko sips on hers gingerly. It is delicious. How'd you come up with that? Max shrugs. It's slow sometimes in the late afternoon, and I have to fill up the time. Well, I'll have another. Miko slams her now empty glass on the countertop. And I'd like another drink, too, just not this exactly. I smile at her. Can I have a Jack Rocks? Max looks surprised, but then the shock fades into the first real grin she's ever given me. Well, 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 Miss Landon. I'd never have pegged you for a Jack girl. She pulls the bottle off the glass shelf behind her. I was born and raised in a dry county. Had to get your alcohol content in hard and fast. Max holds up an ice cube at the end of small tongs. I hold up two fingers in response. She drops the cubes in the finger of whiskey and sets it down in front of me. There may just be hope for you yet. There is. There definitely is hope. There is also some slight depression mixed with disillusionment and maybe the teensiest bit of dark thoughts, Miko agrees, studying me along with my roommate. And how do you know that? I ask. Because I've competed tribute in the games myself. Mika's gaze moves from me to her empty glass. She nudges it towards Max with her index finger. Max takes the hint and starts to make her another one. You're right. I'm definitely bummed out. I look down into my glass. But my mama always said you can get mad and happy in the same pants. I raise my glass to both of them in salute and down a hearty swallow. I don't even wince as it washes down my throat. Jack and I are old friends. What the hell does that mean? Max sets the new shot down in front of Miko. It means that I refuse to let this get me down. I've worked too hard to get here. I won't be detoured. I'll find a way to get through this and come out the other side better for it. I will impress Selah. I will get promoted. I will start my own event planning firm and have a feature in InStyle. I'll do it all. I'm not sure if I'm trying to convince them or myself. Oh, man. Max shakes her head slowly. I know, right? Miko agrees, even though Max didn't actually make a statement. Oh, man, what? I ask, confused. This town is going to chew you up and spit you out. Max is still shaking her head. Miko is using one hand to prop up her head on the bar, but she's nodding along with Max now. It's a definite possibility. I consider their words for a moment, and then a smile slowly curves my lips. Both of them stare at me like I'm going insane, but then they don't know me yet. They don't know that my parents lost four babies before I was born 2 months too early. They don't know that because I was a preemie, I've always been the littlest kid in every class, and have had to fight for acceptance for as long as I've been alive. They don't know that I've been doubted since the moment I was born, and because of that, nothing. Nothing motivates me more than someone telling me I can't do something. My smile is a Cheshire Cat grin now. Oh, girls, you have no idea how much I'm going to enjoy proving you both wrong. I wink and knock back the rest of my drink. Chapter 5. I walk into the office the next morning wearing an all-black version of a Catholic schoolgirl uniform complete with Mary Jane's. It's not a look I'd ever gravitate to, but like I said, my options are limited. It hadn't looked that bad when I stared at it in the full-length mirror on my closet door. But as I walk through the office, I feel like a moron on parade. I've got to go shopping. Walker needs you this morning. McKenna directs me before I'm even all the way into his office. Okay. I drop my bag under the chair in the corner. Walker is... production, he sighs. You should know that by now. Sorry. I'll make flashcards or something, I grumble. I swear, McKenna's lip quivers in an almost smile. But then he turns his head and gets a load of my ensemble. Holy Brittany! Where'd you dig up this outfit? Do you need anything before I go? I ask, ignoring the jibe. I'd tell you if I did. He turns back to his computer. I run to the kitchen quickly for a coffee fix, and then hurry down to the end of the large room where I see Miko clustered around a desk with a few other people. Today, Miko is wearing little black shorts over black tights, an oversized black blouse, a black tuxedo jacket, and faded black Converse. As I walk up, I hear her talking to the group. I like this better. It feels more nautical. Totally. I'll handle it, thanks. I recognize the light-haired girl from the meeting the day before. The small cluster breaks up, having come to a conclusion, and I step up. Hi, I'm looking for Walker. I smile at them. Walker, this is Brinkley, Miko says to the light-haired girl. Brinkley, I'm so grateful we have your help today. We're working on the programs for Saturday, and I need some help with production. Walker flashes me a small smile. Programs? How exciting! I can't wait to see how we make something here. Of course, anything you need, I tell her. Walker holds out a program to me. Back home, we have programs at weddings. Usually the couple will print them out on cardstock, something designed on their computer at home with pictures of themselves and a list of the bridal party and the songs they're playing at the wedding. The program in my hands is like the daddy of those back home programs. No, that's not the right explanation. It's like the father of this program was an oil baron, and he married a Rockefeller, and they had the richest, classiest baby program ever. That's what I'm holding in my hands. The thick navy blue paper shimmers a little with the light. It's been folded over itself to create a rectangle about the size of a business envelope. Ari is embossed in gold in the middle, and the whole thing is held together by a small white rope tied with a really cool little knot. I can tell there's paper inside, but I wouldn't dare open it. I'm hesitant to drop it, it's so fancy. It's nautical and masculine and so awesome looking. This is the knot we decided on, Walker says, pointing to the little white rope. It's called the single carrick bend. You can see how I did it here. She hands me a computer printout that shows the steps necessary to create the intricate knot. You want to try one? She hands me a new program and a length of white rope. It's not really a question. She looks at me expectantly, and Miko looks along with her. Okay. I put the finished program and the directions down on Walker's desk and follow them awkwardly. It takes me a few tries, and it's kind of stressful with them watching, but eventually I create something similar to the perfect example Walker has made. I hold it out to them for inspection. Walker reaches out and adjusts it a little. You see, if you pull here, it'll look a bit neater, she says while she works. Okay, thanks. I study the way her fingers adjust the knot. Great, you can help us tie these then. She stands and starts walking towards the production room, and Miko and I follow her. Once we step inside, I'm immediately overwhelmed by the flurry of activity and the scent of flowers. One whole side of the room is lined with high work tables on which four women are working with what looks like thousands of white flowers. Tons of buckets overflowing with roses cover the floor around them. They work quickly, cutting stems and removing leaves, prepping them for something great, I'm sure. I'm so spellbound by the flower production line that I don't even see where I'm following Walker. I turn around just in time to avoid running into her. She's standing in front of work tables covered with stacks upon stacks upon stacks of shimmery navy blue rectangles. Next to those rectangles are box after box of short lengths of little white rope. It takes a minute for my brain to catch up to my eyes, and I realize I'm looking at my very own production line of hundreds of unfinished programs. My mouth falls open. You can pull over one of those stools. Walker gestures towards the floral side of the room. I'll be back in a while to check on you.
I nod absentmindedly. I shouldn't ask, but I have to know.
How many guests are you expecting?
I try and sound casual.
I think we're at 417 last count, right, Jen?
Walker asks.
I look over at Miko, who's not even trying to hide her smile. I realize now that she followed us here just to see the look on my face when I realize the amount of rope tying I'll be doing today.
That's right. But you know Sayla always wants extra just in case, so I'm guessing there's 500 here.
Better get at it, Sailor.
She actually salutes me. Both of them turn to leave, and I look down at the now wrinkled computer printout of maritime knot-tying directions in my hand. Excuse my language, but it's going to be a long-ass day.
Later that afternoon, around I don't know what time, Miko shows up at my work table with a brown bag in one hand and a to-go coffee cup in the other.
I've brought provisions,
she says, setting them both down in front of me.
God bless you.
I grab the coffee and take a sip. The sugary nirvana of a pumpkin spice latte permeates me all the way down to my toes, and I feel a million times better. In the bag is a sandwich wrap. I don't even look to see what kind it is before I take a gigantic bite.
You know, one of the perks about being on program duty is that no one is looking over your shoulder,
she says, leaning one of her slim hips against the table.
You could leave to get yourself food and caffeine. No one would notice if you were gone for a few minutes.
I've only finished 174. I don't have time to leave, I talk between bites. Plus, with my luck, I'd leave at the exact moment they come to check on me.
This is true. Your luck is pretty bad. I mean, in only a few days here, you've seen Sayla go full bitch at least twice that I know of. Then, the Ken doll fries your synapses, and now you're earning your knot-tying patch.
She fiddles with a loose piece of rope in the box.
Ken doll?
I shove the last of the wrap into my mouth.
Brody Ashton, I saw you dealing with the two of them yesterday. Being trapped by that much combined gorgeousness isn't good for anyone's self-esteem.
You saw that?
I wipe my hands on a napkin from the bag.
Of course I saw that. Anyone with a functioning uterus eye-banged him all the way across the room.
I guess, I mutter, picking up another piece of rope to tie.
Miko leans down to get a better look at my face.
Well, now I know you're full of it. Only a blind woman wouldn't find him sexy as hell. And even then, the guide dog would lead her to him.
She giggles.
I guess he's just not my type.
I continue to work on my knot with the tips of my now raw fingers.
He's everyone's type. Even I'd give him a go, and I hate blondes.
Thanks, I say, mock offended.
You're the exception to the rule, but that's neither here nor there. He's gorgeous and wildly successful, and if rumor is to be believed, he only dates Victoria's Secret models.
Why do you think she wants him so badly?
His superhuman ability to track both man and beast isn't reason enough? I ask, bemused.
One of the first things you will learn about your new boss is that she cares about appearance first and foremost. Brody is the toy that all the other kids want to own, so obviously, Sayla wants to be the one to lock him down. He's a fill-in-the-blank. It could be a purse, a car, a trip, a new pair of shoes. She's constantly in pursuit of shiny things, and well, he's very shiny. Sayla's pursuit, or Brody's prowess, or both, aren't any of my business or concern. I shrug one shoulder, my own way of saying, I don't care either way. I have ropes to tie.
How many now?
Miko asks, throwing away my lunch trash for me.
176, I sigh, continuing to work on the knot.
I'll leave you to it. I've got to completely redesign the lounge layout for Saturday now. Don't ask me why.
She turns to go.
Miko, thank you for lunch. I smile at her. I have no idea why you're so nice to me, but I really, really appreciate it.
Miko stops a few feet away and smiles back at me.
Landon, I'm nice because I like you. And because I used to be you. And when I was you, I was always, always starving and thirsty and afraid to leave to pee.
Really? I ask shyly.
Really. Someday you'll buy a newbie intern a latte and the circle of life will be complete. She throws a nonchalant peace sign over her shoulder and saunters away and out the door.
On the other side of the room, the floral ladies are still at it. Only now someone is blasting the Bee Gees station on Pandora, and they're all humming along. I turn back to my programs, feeling infinitely better. If Miko used to be a lowly, losery intern like me, and is now the coolest person I know, then surely there's hope for me too. Only 322 more ropes to tie. I finish the programs around 9:30 that night. Apparently, Salo doesn't like anything to be finished last minute. I have to admit that I agree with the idea, in the light of day. But this night, I'm not feeling very generous during the last hour of work. When I finally do stumble my way out of the production room door, I am shocked to find the office still alive with people. I'm somewhat mollified by the idea that everyone else is hustling to finish their own projects just like I am. Everyone except Sayla, of course. She clearly doesn't stay late when she has droves of minions to stay for her. When I come in the next morning, I'm down to the last conceivable all-black ensemble I can pull off. I've got on black skinny jeans, black ballet flats, and a plain black t-shirt. The shirt is sort of schlumpy and something I'd never normally be caught dead in outside of the house, but I compensated with a pretty red lip stain and a few more lashes than I'd normally wear. Girl's gotta get her glam in where she can. As I pass by the angry receptionist, whose name is Ambrose, by the way, I am surprised by the quiet in the office. I'd expected pandemonium of pre-event chaos to greet me, but it looks like half the staff isn't even here. I stop by Miko's desk on my way back to the small office. "Where is everyone?" I ask, setting a latte down on her desk. "At the load-in? What's this?" She taps the latte with her pen. "Repayment beverage. Today we're going to try a red velvet latte." I'm sipping on my own. "Thanks. I've been here since 6, and I'm hanging on by a thread. Also, I do love 1,000-calorie coffees," she says, sniffing the drink through the hole in the lid. "Well, since it's likely the only thing I'll eat today, and you can't weigh more than 100 pounds soaking wet, I thought we'd be okay." "A valid point." She sips her drink with relish. "This is amazing." "I know, right?" I turn to head to the office. "I'm headed to the load-in to oversee setup." She starts throwing random things from her desk into her already overstuffed bag. "But I'll catch you later." I stop short and turn back around. "You're overseeing the setup? Shouldn't she be doing that?" I whisper back at her. "Oh, Landon," she says with dismay. "The second thing you'll learn about this new boss of yours is that she just shows up at the last minute, wreaks havoc for an hour, and then takes credit for it all." "Really?" I walk back over to her. I can't imagine not being there for every minute of an event setup if my name was the one on the wall. "Really?" Miko is back to packing up. "Besides, it's not just me. All the team heads go." "What must that be like? To get to watch the whole party come together from the ground up? I'm so jealous. I can't imagine how cool it must be to put all the pieces together." "Don't worry. You'll see more than enough. By tomorrow night, just the sight of navy Dupioni silk will make you want to gag." "You realize I don't know what that is, right?" "You will." Miko runs a hand through her perfectly disheveled hair, grabs her latte, and walks off towards the elevator. That afternoon, the little office is noisier than usual. From my corner, I hear McKenna and Quaid field call after call about the bar mitzvah. Mixed in with all those calls is the usual load regarding the event we have next week, and the three others before month's end. It's the first time it occurs to me how hard it must be to juggle so many high-profile parties at one time. You're not allowed to tell one client you're busy with another client's event. So you're forced to take calls and chat like you're not drowning in your to-do list. Both Quaid and McKenna look worn down, and around 3 o'clock that afternoon, they send me to get them lunch. It's the first time I've seen either of them eat. And even though it's just sushi, I'm sort of relieved that, in their own anorexic way, they're emotional eaters just like I am. On my way home that night, I'm stuck in traffic near Robertson. Katy Perry is crooning on the radio and my windows are down, letting in air that's only slightly chilly. Down the sidewalk and across the street, I see a tall, extremely tan older man wearing a pair of boy shorts, old sneakers, and headphones. His lack of clothing on its own would have caught my eye, but it's the fact that he's dancing wildly that has me inching my car forward trying to figure out what his deal is. As I draw closer, I realize he's dancing along with his own reflection in a storefront window, and I can't help but giggle. Mama would say he's drunker than a run-over yard dog, but I like him. He's clearly a little nuts, but you know what? He's working with it. There he is on this busy street, wearing skivvies and finding his own little moment of joy. My first thought is, I need to be more like that guy. The second is to wonder what this says about the turn my life has taken. I'm idealizing the crazy naked dancing man on Robertson. Chapter 6. McKenna tells me the dress code for the mitzvah is, wait for it, all black. I have to recycle my black cocktail dress from earlier in the week, but this time I pair it with black tights and my black ballet flats. I didn't do many events back in Texas, but it only took one for me to understand that running around in heels for 10 hours is a special kind of torture. I curl my blonde hair like normal, but then I get nervous that maybe I should look a little more conservative since this is a religious event, so I pin it back. I add the pearl earrings Mom and Daddy gave me for graduation and toss a mint green cardigan into my bag. Surely if it gets really chilly, they'll let me wear it even though it's colorful. The party is at the Learner's Home in Bel Air, and I have no earthly idea how anyone can host a party for 400 people in their own home. I'm dying to see how it's done. It's 3:47 p.m. when I pull up to the gate at the address I've been given. Thank God I left over an hour ago, or I never would have made it here on time. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do now. Do I call McKenna? Should I park? Is there a doorbell or something? I chew on my lower lip and lean forward in my seat trying to spot the way to gain access through this ominous-looking gate. Just when I'm about to reverse and try and find street parking, the gate starts to glide open. Before I can put my car into drive, a big guy in a dark suit comes out from behind the gate with a clipboard in his hands and motions for me to roll down my window. Can I help you? Oh gosh, thanks. I was starting to worry I'd sit out here all day, I say brightly. His eyebrows pull in towards his nose, and he gives me a skeptical once over. I'm with SSE. I'm here to help with the party? I don't know why it comes out like a question. Name? He asks, annoyed. Landon, or, maybe Brinkley? Landon Brinkley. The guy runs through several pages on his clipboard before finding whatever it is he's looking for. ID? Is this in case I order a body shot or something? I promise I'm over 21, I say, trying to tease a smile out of him. Security guy is not amused. Sure, sorry, let me just... I reach into the back seat and grab my bag, which is sort of hard to do without flashing security guy the control top of my tights. I finally get to my purse, then my wallet, and produce the ID. He looks at the photo, compares it to my face, and then checks the name on the list. He hands it back and points down the long driveway in front of me. Follow the drive all the way around and back. Staff is parking on the second gravel lot at the bottom of the hill. Thanks, have a nice day, I say with a smile. No response. The driveway winds for a moment between well-manicured lawns before the house comes into view. No, not house. Mansion. Surely something this big and this beautiful gets mansion status. It looks like what you might find in the Italian countryside. At least, I'm assuming this is what homes look like in the Italian countryside. It's peaceful and statuesque, but as soon as I pass by it and continue down the drive, I see the SSE staff scurrying about like a colony of ants. I park my car alongside a bunch of other cars and jump out to look at the spectacle of the backyard. The first answer to the whole, how do you host a party for 400 at home question is that you need a backyard the size of Phoenix. There's got to be at least 2 acres of lawn and landscaping that match the Italian feel of the house. Farther on, the lawn slopes downward, and at the bottom, I can see a tennis court and a guest house that's bigger than the home I grew up in. But closer still is the second thing you need for hosting a party this large, a gigantic tent sitting in the center of the lawn. I've never seen anything like it. It's completely clear on all sides. The only hint of color is the frame, which is all white. The clear roof shines in the sun like glass. For all I know, it is glass. It's so pretty. Through the clear sidewalls of the tent, I can see a flurry of activity setting up tables and chairs
and those lounges that Miko worked so hard to rearrange yesterday. Every single area in the tent is buzzing with people. There's got to be at least 50 staff members setting, straightening, bringing crates in and out, and working on flowers. I'm in awe. I lock my car and head towards the tent. I can't wait to help. Once I walk inside the tent, I'm too flabbergasted to move another step. It's literally too amazing, and my brain cannot process what I'm seeing. I've never been inside a tent that had an actual floor built in. And this tent doesn't have just flooring. The floor is weathered plank hardwood that's been whitewashed and aged in a fantastic play on the nautical theme. The dinner tables are all draped with navy blue silk linens, which must be the Dupioni Miko was talking about. I've only ever seen round tables for big dinners like this one, but this layout is a mix of squares and rectangles. The tables surround the dance floor on all sides, except for a small area where a white stage sits on a pedestal, which has white acrylic walls that come up to the waist of the DJ, who's inside setting up his equipment. In the center of the dance floor, a few men are playing with a remote. Each time they mess with it, the lighting in the tent changes color. It's hard to tell what they're adjusting, because it's still so bright in here through the clear walls, but they keep changing it, adding a bit more pink or a little purple. I watch as the linens on the tables change color subtly. I wonder what it'll look like tonight when it's dark in here. To my left, the ladies from the floral team are placing flowers on tables. The centerpieces are collections of 3 or 4 square glass vases in varying sizes, filled with the white floral arrangements I had seen them working on in the production room. A team of servers wearing black slacks, white button-down shirts, and navy blue neckties. Of course they match the tablecloths exactly. Is setting glassware and plates down on what must be at least 50 tables. Small lounge areas are set up throughout the room, creating cool little vignettes with small sofas and chairs. Everything is stunning and themed, but with the underlying touch of SSE's clean, modern design. It's amazing. I force my slack jaw to close and start walking again to find McKenna. As I move through the tables to the center of the room, I notice the dance floor is thick, clear glass that's covering the span of a lit pool below it. Holy crap! Coolest party ever. McKenna looks up just as I come upon him giving instructions to a handful of servers. The napkin should be a pocket fold. He looks up when he sees me. Brinkley, find the menus and then tuck one inside each napkin. Oh, and let's get you a walkie. He doesn't sound snide or rude, just busy and efficient. This is a pleasant surprise. He turns and I follow him to the far side of the tent where several tables hide behind waist-high acrylic white walls. A handful of men are sitting behind tables covered with computer monitors, wires, mics, and 1,000 buttons and knobs. This is the AV team. Mike, can we get another walkie? He calls to one of the guys as he looks at the screen of his phone. While we wait, I can't help it. I have to say something. Everything looks... it's fantastic! I come very close to squealing the words. McKenna looks up from whatever he's typing into his phone with a nostalgic smile on his face. I remember being that excited once. And now? I can't help but ask. Now? He glances around the room along with me, then sighs. You'll see. Here you go. A big guy dressed in a black t-shirt and black slacks hands me a heavy walkie-talkie. This is your earpiece. He points to the different elements. This is your mic. You can clip it on and press this button to speak. SSE is channel 1, AV is on 2, catering is 3. Got it? Sure. I smile at him. Testing for Brinkley, McKenna says into the mouthpiece clipped to his lapel, and I hear it crisply on the earpiece I've just put on. Can you hear me? I ask back to him into my own mouthpiece, and he nods at me. I grin like an idiot. I've got an earpiece on just like J-Lo in the movie! All right, head over to catering and find the menus. One goes into each napkin. We're room ready at 6:15 for photography, so make it snappy. Definitely. Holding my walkie, I scurry off in search of the menus. The walkie is pretty heavy, and I have nowhere to put it or clip it. Next time, I have to remember to wear something with a waistband so I can attach this beast to something. Music bursts through the speakers as the DJ starts to work with the AV team on the sound. Brittany, Will.i.am, and a thumping bass fill the tent, and I bob along to the beat while tucking expensive-looking embossed menus inside each napkin. Working an event is way more fun than I thought. While I'm on napkin duty, I hear people speaking back and forth in my earpiece in some kind of special walkie-talkie language I've never heard before. McKenna for Taylor, I hear McKenna say. Go for Taylor, Taylor replies. Where are the throw pillows for the lounge setups? Walker is bringing them in now, Taylor replies, and the conversation ends. Davies for McKenna, a sweet British-accented voice says. Go for McKenna? Did Sailor decide on whether we're doing votives in clusters or lines? Lines. Cheers, thanks, Davies answers sweetly. Taylor for Revere, Taylor says. He's on channel 3, someone else responds. Do you need help with those? I've been so busy tucking menus and listening to walkie talk, I haven't even noticed the 3 servers who are standing behind me. One of them points to the menus in my hands. Oh, y'all, that would be great. Thank you so much. I hand each of them a large stack. The photo booth is here. Can someone show him to the Lido deck? McKenna asks into the walkie. When no one responds, I jump on it, eager to help. This is Brinkley. I'll do it. Roger, McKenna says back. I hurry out to the front of the tent and see a man waiting there expectantly. Photo booth? I ask. Yes, I'm Greg. Are you Walker? I think we spoke on the phone. No, that wasn't me. I smile and shake his hand. I'm Brinkley. Oh, sorry. Do you know where I'm supposed to set up at? The Lido deck is where you're headed. Just give me 2 seconds and I'll figure out what that means and where it's located. I look around me confused. No problem. Let me just back the truck down here and then you can tell me where we're headed, okay? Sounds like a plan. I hurry off and search. After 10 minutes of searching the grounds, I still can't figure out where the photo booth is supposed to go, and I'm getting anxious about making the delivery guy wait to unload it. I consider asking someone directions on the walkie, but then everyone will know that I'm clueless. Between admitting to the crew that I can't do a simple job and asking McKenna, the latter seems like the lesser of two evils. And since I can see him on the far side of the tent, I head to him at a near jog. McKenna looks up as I hurry over and slows me with a pointed look. Brinkley, he chides, we never run at an event. He reaches out and straightens the centerpiece on the table in front of him to a precise right angle. I get it. It's not ladylike or classy, but I couldn't figure out where the Lido deck was, and I felt bad because he's out there waiting. Your being ladylike is the least of my concerns, and frankly, a project that's possibly beyond the scope of even my considerable talents. We don't run at events because when party guests see you run, they assume something bad has happened, and he glares at me as if willing his words to imprint on my brain. Nothing bad happens at an SSE party. This piece of information is incredible. I knew their team was talented, but it has never occurred to me they might be so well-oiled that they never had to troubleshoot. I have to learn what they do to prepare to ensure they don't have any issues day of. Really? Back in Texas, we always had at least 1 or 2 disasters at any of the events I interned. McKenna looks increasingly annoyed with every word that falls from my mouth, which makes me nervous and only serves to make me talk faster and my accent more pronounced. Miss Opal Teagarten, that's the planner I worked for over in Houston last summer, her motto was, prepare for the flood. And no matter how much we tried to do that, there was always something that he finally snaps. Why are you still speaking? I stare at him blankly. Of course things happen at our events. Don't be an idiot. The point is that our guests are never aware of them. So whatever happens, keep yourself in check until you're out of sight. Perception is reality. Got it? I nod at him at the same time he grabs a packet of paperwork out of the binder under his arm and hands it to me. You made the copies of this. You think you'd grab one for yourself. He turns to walk away. The map is on the last page. I suggest you take a preemptive approach to that timeline going forward. I look down in my hands at the 12-page timeline and feel like the big idiot he said I was. I'd spent at least an hour printing, collating, and stapling the agenda for the SSE team. It should have occurred to me to look at it for direction on where setup should be. I flip quickly to the last page, heading back towards the delivery guy at a brisk walk instead of a run. Turns out the Lido deck is the name for a second tent that is set up in back. I'd never heard the name before, but when I mention it to Mika later, she assures me that rich people with boats find it clever. The Lido deck is about a quarter of the size of the main tent, but it doesn't have clear walls. This tent is wide on the outside, and inside, a thick, velvety drape covers every square inch from floor to ceiling. Because no sunlight can peek through the walls of the tent, the lighting in here is stellar. It's all blues and greens morphed into cool shapes or thrown around the room by lasers. In the center of the space, a light shines onto the ground, big bold letters that spell Ari, in case anyone forgets who the party is for. Lights shift and move in time with the music coming from yet another DJ, and every inch of the space is filled with activity stations. There's a photo booth currently being set up, a vintage arcade with at least 7 games, a place to screen print your own t-shirt, tables full of glass vases filled with different kinds of candy, all of which are blue, and even a bar featuring mocktails. I can't believe this space, which has to cost at least 50 grand, is for a bunch of 13-year-olds. All I'd wanted for my 13th birthday was a purple velour juicy jumpsuit. And no joke, my dad gave me a shotgun and a gift certificate for Hunter's education classes down at the sporting goods store. Clearly, Ari and I come from different worlds. The bars need their framed menus. Who's on it? Someone asks into the walkie. This is Brinkley. I'll grab them. I hurry out of the little tent and off in search of the menus. We need pens. The guestbook has no pens. McKenna barks into the walkie. This is Brinkley again. I'll get the pens when I grab the menus. Give me 2 minutes. I hope I don't come across as a teacher's pet, but I can't seem to help myself. Roger. Did photo booth get set up? Someone asks as I head up to the production van. Yes, he's just finishing his setup now. I told them we're room ready at 6:15 for photos. I feel very official and important answering questions into my mouthpiece and fetching bar menus. It can't take me more than a handful of minutes to grab the supplies, but by the time I walk back into the main tent, the mood has changed. Selah has arrived and is fit to be tied. From what I can tell, she hates the setup of the lounges, and now everyone is scrambling to change them around. At least 12 people are working with her trying to lay out the room differently, which is actually really tough since there's so much furniture in the tent. Moving one thing means moving everything else around it, too. I try not to draw attention to myself as I walk the menus to each bar, and then turn back to the chaos. I don't really want to enter Selah's orbit, but she's with Quaid and McKenna. Since they're my bosses, I don't really have a choice. Selah is wearing a black sheath dress with black stiletto boots. She looks flawless, but for the snarl on her face. I can't fathom why it's never ready when I arrive on site, she says hatefully. This layout looks terrible, and now I have to stand here and wait while you put everything back the way it should have been to begin with. I come up and stand off to the side of the group. Production sets up, McKenna sighs. Yes, and don't you have eyes? Surely you could see that the room looked like shit, she bites back. This is what happens when a design is altered at the last minute. Wait, isn't she the one who had them change the whole design at the last minute? I know, it's so frustrating. Thank God you're here. It already looks so much better, McKenna coddles. I look around the space before me. It looks great this new way, but it also looked great the old way, and there really isn't enough of a change to warrant the scramble. All around me, people are hurried and nervous-looking. It's odd, because half an hour ago, I thought we all seemed prepared and confident. We're only a few minutes into the party when I hear Quaid's voice screech through my earpiece. What the fuck is going on with these bar menus? She demands to no one in particular. I look at the bar across the tent from where I've been stationed greeting guests. I'm expecting to see Quaid's body language reflecting the angry tone in her voice, but at this distance, she looks totally controlled and normal as she whispers viciously into her walkie. These menus are for the Lido deck. We've got guests wondering why their signature drinks are named after Halo characters, and parents freaking out because the menus in the deck have alcohol listed in them. The bottom drops out of my stomach.
I hadn't even thought to check and see which bar menu went where. I'd assume they were all the same. I reach for my walkie so I can apologize. My bad. I'll swap those out right now. I haven't heard him on the walkie much today.